Accession number 4549, reel 5.
Mr. Viles, reel 5. I think that whilst you were with 70's Squadron, you used to make flights to Egypt.
Yes, we had a fortnightly effort there where we used to fly one of the aircraft of 70's Squadron that was designated by the commanding officer would fly to Egypt to pick up stores and spares that they needed urgently. And they would report in, they would fly over, and the first landing would be at the Imperial Airways landing strip in Iraq at Rutbar Fort. That was the only landing ground there until you got to Baghdad. And refuel there, and carry on from there to Amman, to 14 Squadron, and refuel there. And from Amman, carry on to detached flight of 6 Squadron at Ramleh in Palestine, and refuel there. And they were very awkward to get in there because you had to come in over some very high metal railings, and the airfield sloped up like that, in an upward slope.
This was at Ramleh, wasn't it?
At Ramleh. And you had to come in over these railings and land quickly then, because if you didn't, and you overshot a little, you were over the top and into the cemetery at the top.
Were there ever any accidents?
We didn't have an accident. I didn't know of one in my time. But I heard of one prior to my time, that was all, where one did shoot over, went skidding through everything. No one was hurt. And then from Ramleh, it was a case of flying down to Ismailia, to the other flight, a detachment flight from Ramleh. There was a flight of their aircraft at Ismailia, and to number 4 flying trains. No, not number 4. Yes, number 4 flying training school at Abaswir on the Suez. And then from there, our last port of call was at the aircraft depot, where the aircraft stayed the night and returned the next day. And if anyone was going on leave, which they were entitled to after being in Iraq a year, they would get off the aircraft at Abukir, be attached to the RAF depot there for a fortnight, and be given a pass. And they would go off on leave to Alexandria or Cairo, wherever they wanted to go. And as long as they reported back in time for the incoming aircraft a fortnight later to go back onto Iraq. And that was a pretty bad trip across Transjordan. It was very jumpy and bumpy. And I'm afraid a lot of our nurses and our passengers were always ill. We had to give them these big brown bags and send them out to the back. And let them if they felt like it.
How different was it being with 70 Squadron as compared with 55 Squadron?
Well, it was entirely different because on 55 Squadron, I was not only the rigger on my own aircraft, I was the gunner on my own aircraft, and I had a close cooperation with my pilots in that respect. But with 70 Squadron, there were no air gunners. It was a bomber transport unit, and it was mostly transport. Well, it's practically 95% transport. And we had no guns or anything aboard like that. It was just a matter of transport flying all over the place. And eventually, in 1933, 70 Squadron were chosen to pick out the first route to Singapore for long-distance training for the air crews of the other squadrons from Iraq in the event of war of any type. A world war, that would be. And when I'd left there and went to India, in fact, I went to the squadron that was the first squadron to go to Singapore on the same route that we designated out on that original flight.
Can you describe that long-distance flight?
It took off at Baghdad and flew down to Basra and then down to Muscat in the Persian Gulf and then to Chokin. That's right, just round the corner, the bottom of the Gulf, right round the corner, the bottom of the Gulf. And then to Karachi. From Karachi to Allahabad. Allahabad to Cox's Bazar, that's just outside Calcutta. And then down the coast of Malaya through, I'll just think of these places now. I think they go like this. Mergui was the first place to stop. Aloe Star was the second. Rangoon was the third. And then there was one stop between Singapore and Rangoon. I can't quite remember it. And then on to Singapore. At each place, we stayed the night, and we refueled and did any inspections we had to do, and met the local... Whether we met local people all the way down, especially white people, English people, in the clubs there, and we went to several of the clubs on the way down. And on the way back, we had a great royal welcome on the way back. And the first squadron to actually do that flight, they decided that it should be from India to make it shorter, first of all, to see how it went. And 11th Squadron, my squadron, was the first one to go, and I went with them.
Did any problems crop up on the flight?
Not with the... there was one snag with one of the Victorias. It had to force land with the with engine trouble, Conrad through the sump, and it landed on the beach there, on the Malay beach, somewhere between Mergui and Aloe Star, I believe the two places were. And it just landed on the beach with one engine. And the crew stayed with it. There was a guard put on it. And they flew out another engine, and within within 9 days, it was back at base.
So the flight was a success, you think?
Yes, oh yes, the flight was a success. We definitely, we laid the route that should be taken. We found the route that should be taken. The only snag was that some of the airfield was so small, and we hadn't got brakes on our aircraft then. And it was a hard job to pull them up. And you had to do a transverse landing across corner to corner on some of the airfields. They were so small, coming in over the palm trees and dropping in. Quite hard, too. That was the only time. We always thought the undercart might go.
Flying conditions in a country like Malaya must have been completely different to those in Iraq.
No, it was the same sort of... You had the same sort of temperatures. Humidity was much more. It was about 90% plus all down the Malaya coast. But in Iraq, it was a drier heat. That was the only difference. And I always thought that our aircraft are always tested so well before they get a certificate of airworthiness. This is the difference between, I think, the Royal Air Force and British aircraft and other country aircraft. They don't get the testing that our aircraft are tested under every condition possible at home to start with. Under all the snags are ironed out. Then under the coldest conditions they can put them under, they're flown in and looked at. Then they're put under the most heated condition of foreign countries with humidity and dry heat. And they're flown and flown and flown to find out if there's any fault with them. And then finally they get a certificate of worthiness before the air ministry accept them and pass them out to squadrons. And even then you get little snags show up. Modifications were needed all the time.
Can you think of any examples of snags and modifications that were made?
Yes, the instance I gave you of the engine changing of the Vickers Victorias to the Vickers Valencias from the old Napier line where the engine kept going and the Conrads going to the sumps. And the modification was they should be come out and two extra struts should be put in at the top and the bottom and the engine should be held on those struts on a frame, the new Pegasus engine. And that was a modification. And the aircraft was that's all that it was renamed for because of that engine changing from the Victoria to Valencia. Nothing else was changed. And we used them for loudspeaking to warn the villagers, too, in times of operations or any rebel turn-ups, anywhere. We would go over and we had loudspeakers which we could take... put out to the bottom, and we always sent a man with them who could speak the language and tell them in their own language and also in English. So we made sure that they were understanding both ways. And even those that didn't know the English, those that on the ground that did would translate it to them. And these loudspeakers used to boom down on them. They could hear it all right from about 5,000 feet.
Well, the crews who took part in the long-distance flight to Singapore, all volunteers?
No, they were all their own, the pilots that flew their own aircraft and their own gunners. That's all that went. if there were gunners on the aircraft. Well, on the Vickers Victoria, when we did the instigation flight of this, there, of course, there were no gunners, but the fitter and the rigger went with his own aircraft in case of an emergency. So he was there to do anything.
Were you glad that you were picked to go?
Oh, very glad indeed. I thought it was quite an honour, really, to be able to go on a trip like that. And, of course, you see, the difference between 55 and 70 was that I was being paid as an air gunner with 55 Squadron, 6 pence a day from my badge, that shouldn't fly in danger pay. But when I got to 70 Squadron, there were no air gunners there, but I was on the crew of my own aircraft, so we got a shilling a day only, danger pay. But as I was an air gunner, having to pay me danger pay, they had to pay me badge pay as well. So I got my 1/6, where the others who weren't ex-air gunners didn't. Just if you were an ordinary fitter rigger and you hadn't got an air gunner's badge qualified, you only got your shilling a day. But if you were qualified, they had to give you both.
We've missed out a period that you spent in 1932 at Basra with 203 Flying Boat Squadron.
That's right.
Could you tell me about what happened there?
Yes. 203 Squadron comprised four aircraft, short Rangoons, three-engine aircraft, all metal. The first aircraft we were allowed to smoke in or cook in or do anything like that. And there was one aircraft to each flight, A, B, and C, and the fourth one belonged to Commanding Officer Group Captain Walsh. And our job there was to patrol the Persian Gulf in conjunction with the Navy, with the four sloops that were in the Gulf then. And our job was to make sure that everyone was happy and that no little state was interfering with another little state. Or if they did, we went in and stopped it, or warned them. They'd be bombed if they weren't stopped or gunned or whatever. And this was our job all the time. And we used to take off down the bottom end of the Tigris into the Persian Gulf. But we were actually on the Tigris. Our jetty, where the aircraft went down on a steel pulley, a cable, they were slidden down. They were amphibious, by the way. They would land on water or on sea, and the wheels used to come up and fit into the flying boat structure, and the curve went the same. And we used to have a 3-mile run for takeoff in those. Just on 100 miles an hour was our flying speed, 3-engine aircraft. And after I left them, they were designated to represent the Air Ministry at the Sydney Centenary celebrations. Just as I left them, went back to 70 Squadron. And they were designated on my last year there, early 34, to fly to Australia. And they went to Australia. I missed that. They went to Australia. And they represented the Air Force at the Sydney Centenary celebrations. Took them 6 weeks to get there. They took 6 weeks' pay. They had 6 weeks there in Sydney Harbour. And they came back. It took them 6 weeks to get back. And they all came back with more pay than they took. They hadn't got any more pay after that. They still had 6 weeks' pay to come that they were there, and another 6 weeks for flying back. They had 12 weeks' pay to come, and they still had more pay than what they went with.
What did you think of the Rangoon?
I didn't think very much of them, to be quite truthful. I didn't think they were fast enough, for a start off, for the power they had in them. Three Bristol Pegasus engines. I always thought that they were suspiciously open to damage. We hadn't got the facilities to check the river as it should be checked before takeoff for anything floating. And it was shark infested as well, because we used to catch the shark off the jetties and eat them. And the slightest dent, you see, you had to cut that piece of metal out and put a plate in. And you had to have a back frame in to hold it, which overlapped. You cut a piece out, like that, and you had to fit in then a back plate that overlapped where your cutout was around there, all the way around, and rivet it all the way around, and then fit in your plate and rivet it onto that back plate, and seal around the edges with sealing where it fitted in to make sure there was no leak or anything. The only good thing about them was we were allowed to smoke and we were allowed to cook on them, our own food, and we carried our own food, which is a good thing.
Why were the different rules regarding smoking?
Because they were all metal aircraft. There was no wooden parts in the facility of the galley or anything like that. And we used to smoke just forward of the galley, and there was no wood there. But once you got forward of the galley, of the place where we were allowed to smoke, then no smoking. And there was a gunner right up in the nose, and there was a gunner rear of the wings.
How spacious were they?
They were quite spacious. There was room for beds. We had little beds that fitted up against the side that brought down, and you just put on a sort of a Copac mattress to lay on, and a blanket over you.
A what mattress?
Filled with Copac. It's sort of a... I don't know what it's made of, Copac. I think it's off some animal. And it's like a cotton wool, only in a sort of a furry form. You can buy it now anyway, but it's quite expensive now.
So the presence of these sharks made you a bit nervous, did it?
No. We never thought about the sharks. Only catching them. And we used to get the blacksmith to make us our big barbed hooks about that big, with a barb on, and a cable. We used to splice a cable trace onto ourselves, because that was part of our job, riggers, to be able to splice cable.
These were hooks about 6 inches, 9 inches long.
Yeah, and quite a big thing. And we used to go and get a big hunk of fat pork from the cookhouse, which wasn't going to be used as... It had been, they deprived of it all, its juice, and left the hunk of fat and the rind on it. So we used to put a great hunk of that on it and stand on a jetty like this and just whirl it out and pull it in like that.
Were they easy to catch?
Oh, they would go. Yeah, they would go for it if there was any around.
How big were they?
The largest I ever saw there weighed somewhere around about 400 to 500 pounds. It was quite a big one. And it just brought it ashore, and as it brought it ashore, you hit it on the head with a mallet, and that killed it instantly. That's as weak as any fish, weakest spot on the head. Just hit it, a good blow. And we always carried a big wooden mallet with a long handle on, so you could stand back and hit it, kill it, and chop it, cut his head straight off, and throw it back in the water. Sharks would take that. And then we would take the flesh. It was beautiful white flesh, better than any cod you'll ever taste.
How did life at Basra compare with Hinadi?
Not so good. We had Baghdad, which was open to us, except certain parts, which we weren't allowed to go into. But on the whole, Baghdad to us was an open city, more or less. And we had a lot of social life there as well. At Basra, we hadn't got... The nearest town to us was Basra, and we hadn't got the social life there at all. And consequently, it threw them more into their... to be sort of interned in their own camp. Because they hadn't got... They just hadn't got a life to go out to, and they hadn't got the money to spend to go out to. And it was much more expensive in Basra than Baghdad, I found. And I think that was the main reason that people didn't like Basra at all. And the one thing that everyone kept away if they could was malaria. Malaria were bounded there. And I was the only one in my room of 22 who didn't use a mosquito net.
Why was that?
I found there was everyone in my room. They weren't from Baghdad, of course. They would belong to Basra and 203 Squadron. And I happened to have a bed in this room. There was 24 of us. And I was the only one that didn't catch malaria. And what I did, I slept straight under... We all had these fans down the room going all the time, and I slept directly under a fan, naked, with just a towel across my back and bottom, and I laid on my tummy and went to sleep. And if the mosquitoes came into that downflow of air, they were immediately beaten out. I found that out pretty quick up at Baghdad.
So you didn't get bitten?
I didn't get bitten by the... But they were malaria-infested down there, so... That's the reason I got attached down to 203 Squadron, because all the air gunners but one, who had fallen off the top of the top wing and broken his thigh, all the air gunners there, the rest of them were in hospital with malaria. And there were four gunners attached down there. It was one hours only, one from 70, two from 55, and one from 30. No, one from 84 Squadron at Shaiba. That was about 62 miles out in the blue from Basra.
What about the weather at Basra?
Very humid. The river was steaming, and it was moving too. It was doing about 5 knots, that river was. You could see it moving fast, little ripples, you know, how it turns over in little sort of currents. And yet it was steaming all day long and all night long. Steam, steam, steam. The humidity was terrible. I didn't like Basra at all. I was trying to get back to Baghdad.
How did you get on with the Iraqis?
Well, I didn't. The only Iraqis that I got along with, they weren't actually Iraqis, they were Kurds. And my reason for getting along with that, I found a Kurdish falconer. And I was always interested in bird, and especially in falconry. And he taught me all the tricks of the trade in falconry. And this I carried on in India as well. And this eventually got me the job I eventually got with as the Air Ministry Falconer in Chief I was. And I was responsible only to my commanding officer at Air Ministry, who was an Air Commodore. And he was the officer in charge of accidents prevention. But I was in charge of the falcons.
Why did the Air Ministry have a falconer in chief?
Well, they tried everything to clear airfields. And they could find nothing, no way of doing it, not to be permanent.
To clear them of birds?
Bird flocks, yes, and bird strikes. But they'd been chasing around a millionaire up in Shropshire who did nothing else but falconry. He's the leading exponent on the Peregrine Falcon, Ronald Stevens. And they've been out, he was a private in the army during the war, on the Scilly Isles, intercepting German pigeons from Ireland to France and getting the messages off them. That was the only job he did as a private, him and his two falconers, two civvies. And he was the man that trained us eventually, and they've been after him for a couple of years, and he said, no, you can't train a falcon, he's born a falconer. He's got to be born. You can't train him. Well, in the end, they pestered him so much that he decided to take on falconry. This was in 1947. He decided to try it anyway. And an order went out for anybody to volunteer for it. So I volunteered right away. And I don't know how, there was well over 1,000 people put in for it. And I was the only one with previous experience. And I got the job, I was sent straight up to RAF Slambeda, where they had an ex-airman, who was Ronald Stevens, trainer, falconer up there. A young fellow named Terry O'Reilly. And he had finished his service after the war and got out. And he was supposedly training these airmen. But when I went up first, and I found out that, right away, that he didn't know much about falconry. There were a lot of things that I learned in Iraq and India, of course, that were not allowed in England.
Such as?
In Iraq and India, they used to drug them with root drugs to make them very hungry, so they would go after the prey. Because they were their means of living in that country. They would take the falcon out to kill for them, and they would give it the head and the feet, which they didn't want, and take the rest themselves.
What were these root drugs?
I don't know what they called them or where they got them. They never told me. They wouldn't tell me. And I found out that poor Terry O'Reilly, he just knew the very basic rudiments of falconry. And I was teaching him things in the end. And I was supposed to have gone up there for 3 weeks training. Well, after 3 days, he must have phoned up Ron Stevens to tell him that I was teaching him. And he said, right, send him straight down here. Well, the squadron leader came the next day from Air Ministry. That was my Air Commodore's deputy. And he came out. He said, by the way, he said, Miles, he said, I'm taking you back with me to Mr. Stevens' home in Shropshire. And he had his family were the biggest hardware exporters in England. That's, when I say hardware, I mean China work, that sort of stuff. And they were millionaires. And his family had bought up Walcott Hall in Lidbury North, Shropshire, near Walshpool. And what had happened was that originally Clive of India's son had married Lord Powis's daughter, and they'd taken the name of Clive Powis, and they owned the whole of Shropshire between them until taxes started levelling them off, and the Stephen family eventually bought Walcott Hall, one of their homes, and all its beautiful land and lake, and we were stationed in this beautiful home, a lovely lake, trout fishing, up the end, traps for catching ducks, which he, and he had all, he owned all the Shropshire moors, and he had these false pools dug out where the marshes were, and sanded, and reeded, and he used to let these pigeons loose, ducks loose up there, for, just for falconry purposes. Then he had all the grouse out in the gorse there. And he used to do it all the year round. Then he'd let all his falcons go free, at the end of the year. And next year he'd get another lot, he'd start training them and go up with them again.
Which years were these when you were at this hall?
Oh, Walcott Hall? Mm. 1947. And we used to go up in his Rolls Royce from Walcott Hall up to his hunting lodge on the Shropshire Moors and back every day in a Rolls Royce.
So it was during the Second World War that Stevens had had this job intercepting
yes,
German
yes,
pigeons?
Yes, he was a private in the army, yeah. I believe he's attached a signal score.
And
he now lives in Ireland to avoid tax.
And so when you were in Iraq and you learnt this falconry, how did it come about that these Iraqi falconers were willing to tell you all about their tricks of the trade?
Well, this particular one that I met and knew, he could speak English. And that's why we got on so well together. And he would ask me about my home and what I did and what my family were and what they did. And all that, and he would tell me about his family and his friends that lived around. And he took me around to several of their very interesting little churches up in the mountains in the when we were up in the Kurdish Valley. I went up there we had a rest camp at a place called Saramadir, right 3 miles from the Turkish border up in Kurdistan. And his family lived about 8 miles away in the hills, right against the Turkish border. Only he used to come down to Mosul, and he lived between Baghdad and Mosul. And I met him in Baghdad, first of all. And he was waiting in a hotel there. That's how I come to know him, because I knew the manager of the hotel, who was half English and half Iraqi. His name was Thompson. And he could still be there. He owned this hotel, and that's how I got to know him. And he came over to see me when I was up at Saramadir. And he told me, he said, I think I should take you, he said, to show you some of our little villages just round here. There's three round here I'd like you to see. And he took me to their little churches. And one of them had a Bible in there. A Bible, mark you, which was chained to the wall. And I don't know what language it was in, but it was over 1,000 years old. But nobody dared take that Bible. He was a dead man. They'd have had him. And they used to come from all the villages around to these different little churches. And out from the hills and where they lived in the caves, they would come in and go to church there, whatever. They were Orthodox, I think, Greek Orthodox type of people. Something like that. They weren't the same as the Iranians are now, Ishmaels or whatever you call them, Islamic. They were more of a Greek Orthodox, there was a cross really between that and the Greek Orthodox Church. There's always been a row over this in that area, between Turkey, Kurdistan, Iraq, Iran and all around there. There's always been this, because of this Orthodox Church.